Good morning, everybody. Welcome to Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society. I am Molly Plunkett. Prairie aspires to be both an open-hearted and open-minded congregation. We welcome people of every ethnic and religious background, whatever your color, sexual orientation, gender, or family structure. We welcome you no matter what your age or your abilities or inabilities. Later in the service, we'll want to hear from anybody who is here for a first time or returning. On Sunday mornings, we have a wide variety of services. They are presented by Prairie members, a member of the wider community, such as we have today with Linda Ketchum from Madison Urban Ministry, or our minister, Sandra Ingram. And as I said, today we have Linda Ketchum. We have opening words today that are going to be read for us by Donna.
No person, I think, ever saw a herd of buffalo of which a few were fat and the great majority lean. No person ever saw a flock of birds of which two or three were swimming in green and the others all skin and bone. Henry George.
We are fortunate today to have as our speaker Linda Ketchum, who is the director of Madison Urban Ministry. I think you all know that I put out on the Yahoo Prairie listserv a lot of information that I call from their newsletters about their activities. I think MUM has been in operation since 1971, and Linda may be, well, I don't know how many directors, I know several of them, her predecessors. Linda's been director of Madison Urban Ministry since 2006. She came to Wisconsin from Illinois, where she had worked for Lutheran Social Services in their prisoner and family ministries. She also worked with addiction counseling, and in various capacities, she worked with that organization for 10 years. She said to me she's been working in the area of social services for 33 years at this point. She has degrees, undergraduate and graduate, in the area of criminal justice. I think you see Linda's name and references to Madison Urban Ministry frequently in this community now. I was looking at a magazine, Our Lives, which I picked up because of a building that was on the cover that I liked. There's an article in there by Linda about the white privilege conference that's going on, I think, right now, right? And I particularly liked, and I don't know if I chose it who did, but the caption that was come up with for the program today, which is Madison Urban Ministries on the Move. This is an organization, I think, that has always been doing great work, but is, if anything, even more vital now. So I'm just going to leave it to Linda to tell you more about what they're doing and how we can all be involved.
Good morning. Thanks for inviting me. I really appreciate it. It's nice to see some familiar faces, Barb, Tilly. I see a few people I know. It's always nice. As Molly mentioned, we were created in 1971, and in part, we came from the old Pilgrim Congregational Church, which was on the Isthmus area. Do you know where the Wilmar Neighborhood Center is?
Yeah.
Okay, the Wilmar Neighborhood Center is the old Pilgrim Congregational Church. And in the 1960s and 1970s, that congregation had been doing some community organizing and focusing on areas of racism, access to education, fair and affordable housing, a number of issues that they really cared about and saw as crucial to the people moving into the neighborhood. And so they had started this work, but the congregation itself was getting older and was unable to keep their doors open. So when they decided to close and dissolve, they went to First Congregational United Church of Christ and said, if we give you our assets, will you do something with it to further the work that we have started here? And so I like to give that a little bit of the history so you understand on the move how we got here from there. So they went to First Congregational, and First Congregational formed a committee called Servants on Errands. And that committee spent a couple of years discerning what the mission and purpose of such an organization, such a social justice organization, should be. And they came up with a few things. One was an incubator, because the people at Pilgrim had started to be an incubator. They had opened the church doors to the Neighborhood Association, which was meeting there. And so First Congregational said to the Neighborhood Association, you take the building. You take the building and create a neighborhood center. It's needed in that area. And so that's how the Wilmar Neighborhood Center was born. They took the remaining assets and decided that we should continue that incubator work, but also look at that social justice work. We should study issues, convene people of faith together and talk about these issues and come up with some action plans. So also under that incubator purpose, all of the senior coalitions in the city of Madison, Project Home, formerly it's now merged with to become Centers for Family, but Family Enhancement, the organization that was the predecessor, it merged with CHAZ in 2004 to become Porch Light, but it had been the organization Transitional Housing to work to create the shelter, the men's shelter at Grace Episcopal Church for homeless single men. So those are some of the programs that were incubated and spun off, and it's always been a goal to spin those things off. But in the 1990s, we started to look at all those issues we had focused on, racism, housing, economic justice, and where all of it converged for us was in the criminal justice system. And we started to think about how do we address this? So we created our Justice Issues Task Force, because that's what we do. We create task forces to study things. And ideally, unlike sometimes the task forces that government entities form, something actually happens. And so we created the task force, and we started to look at these issues. Juvenile justice, we looked at, Mom was one of the groups out there protesting the creation of the Supermax prison in Boscobel. Looking at truth in sentencing, which we like to call kind of half-truth in sentencing, since the final reforms were never put into place. We looked at, how can we educate the community? So we created this thing called a returning prisoner simulation. And how many of you have ever been through a returning prisoner simulation with Mom? Oh. One person. So, well, we'll extend an invitation for the ones coming up later this summer. It's an opportunity, it's a role play. It's a service learning, it's a learn by doing activity. You get to try to maneuver all the activities that someone newly released from prison has to do the first 30 days out of prison. And so you get your new identity for a few hours, and there are stations around the room, and you try to maneuver those things. And you try to, and see what some of those barriers are. Employment, housing, connecting with mental health treatment, substance abuse treatment, childcare, transportation, all of those things that people have to deal with when they're newly released from prison, plus reporting to your probation or parole agent. So we put the simulations together, and an interesting thing happened. Some people who are formerly incarcerated saw our posters and thought, what possibly could these well-intentioned church people know about what we're dealing with? So they came to some of the simulations, and they told us, actually, you guys kind of understand. And so we started to work with them. And another group formed, Voices Beyond Bars, which was incubated under Mom until 2010 when they spun off. We started to look at that and we thought, you know, there's so much related to this issue. And so at the same time we're doing the simulations in 1998, another group called, through the Wisconsin Women's Network, the Women in Criminal Justice Task Force, was working on creating a program to benefit children of incarcerated parents. because those are, the kids are really the collateral damage of our correction system, right? There is not, there's no parent that serves their time alone. The children always serve the sentence with their parent. So this other group called itself Family Connections, and that's how I first became acquainted with Mom. I had just moved up here from working for the Family Connections program for Lutheran Social Services down in Illinois. And we had an anonymous donor, and she said, create something to help kids and moms who are in prison, and I'll give you $10,000 if you raise the matching money. So we got to work on it. How many of you know Sister Esther Heffernan? Mm-hmm. Okay, that. When I moved here from Illinois, my boss, Sister Pat Davis, said, find my friend Esther when you get to Madison, and things will be revealed. So if you know Esther, you know that that's true. So I found Esther, and she was part of that task, that Wisconsin Women's Network group. So we went to Mom and said, we need an incubator for our Family Connections program. So that was in 1999. We started taking children to Tachita Correctional Institution to visit their moms in prison. And that program has been running ever since. It spun off from Mom, and then in 2010, and that was 2004, 2010, the economy kind of tanked. Their board had voted to dissolve as an organization, but by that time, Madison Area Urban Ministry had created another program for children of incarcerated parents called Mentoring Connections, providing community-based one-to-one mentoring for kids who have a parent in prison or jail. We said, we'll take Family Connections back under our roof as a permanent program if that's okay with you. And so their board voted to do that, and they came, as we like to say, and as Esther says, Family Connections came back home. So we're very happy that the program still runs. We expanded it a little bit, so we have Family Connections takes kids to visit their parent, their moms, and then Reading Connections takes volunteers into the institutions to record parents reading books to their kids, parents who don't get visits. So we created that program. And then we started looking at another program called Circles of Support that matched groups of volunteers with people who were newly released from prison to provide support. Now, how many of you, when you go into the grocery store or like, I know none of you go into Walmart, so that's cool. But some of the big box stores, and you know, there's the greeter at the door, and they look at you and make eye contact, and they say, hi. You know, and now do they do that because they want us to feel, because they love us? As nice as it would be, and maybe some of them do. But actually, there's research that says when you make contact with somebody, make eye-to-eye contact with somebody, they're less likely to steal from you because you've created a bond. And so in a way, Circles of Support is kind of that same idea. When people who are returning from prison make connections and forge relationships with people in the community, it supports them and helps motivate them to really want to continue to be successful and work to re-engage in the community, as well as those people serving as resources for them. We also have our Journey Home program that is more of a case management program. But Peter had said, you know, there's nothing like a good story. And so I could go on and on and talk, but I just wanted to share a few stories that I think help illustrate what our services do and then kind of give you an idea why we're creating some, why we're working on some of the new initiatives that we're working on. So Eddie had spent most of his life in prison, and as the years wore on, he wasn't sure he could imagine himself ever being free. But he was free at age 60 after serving 18 years for a burglary. And when we met Eddie, he was still in prison and he was a stranger to this community after 18 years away. He asked for a circle of support. So he got those six volunteers who agreed to meet with him weekly, providing support, a resource, a safe place to share, and a new community. His circle met with him for over a year. They helped him with job and apartment leads. They encouraged him when no one would hire him, and that's a huge barrier. And we find, I mentioned Walmart, we have the most luck connecting people with jobs with the smaller locally owned employers. They're much better corporate neighbors and citizens, and so I always just encourage people, shop locally. He was, in the story I really want to get to, so Eddie was denied a job. When he was in prison, he did 18 years in the cafeteria at the prison in the kitchen cooking, right? See, 18 years of experience as cooking. He saw a job advertised in the University of Wisconsin for fry cook in one of the dorms, so he applied. He was clearly overqualified, but he was denied an interview, and they told him it was because the nature of his offense, burglary, was substantially related to the nature of the job, fry cook. And we were very intrigued. So we said, Eddie, you could appeal this, because this doesn't make any sense. And so we said, and if you appeal it, I'll go with you. Our associate director, Everett Mitchell, at the time, will go with you. Your circle of support will go with you. And I'm going to call a friend of mine who named Jerry Hancock, who happens to be a lawyer and also a minister. And so I called Jerry and I said, would you bring your lawyer brain and wear your clergy collar, because we don't want them to know you're a lawyer. And so Jerry agreed to come as well. So we all went with Eddie. We weren't allowed to ask questions. And he's sitting with the HR person for the UW. And she explains to him that all of the cafeteria equipment is paid for by student fees. Therefore, it is student property. And so, as a fry cook, he would have access to student property, which means that his burglary conviction is substantially related to the nature of the job. And I'm sitting next to Jerry, who's frantically writing. And I'm, what is this? And we weren't allowed to say anything. Eddie could ask questions, but so we leave, and Jerry said, Eddie, I can't imagine a judge in this county who's going to buy this. I'll represent you pro bono. What do you say? And Eddie said what about 90% of the men and women with whom we work said, which was, I don't want to become known as a troublemaker. I need a job. I'm not going to appeal it. I mean, think of the contortions that woman went through. And you know, when I go out and when I share that story, she could be sitting here, I don't know. But I think it's important to speak truth to power and to say, this was wrong. But it's the day-to-day reality of the men and women we work with, that employers will go to such lengths to deny them employment. So Eddie never got a job with the UW, never. But he did get a job at the church where his circle of support came from, who hired him as their maintenance worker. An affluent congregation, major renovation, new equipment, new buildings, and for the remaining years of his life, Eddie had the keys to that building and nothing ever went missing. And that's part of why I hope someday whoever denied him that job will be sitting in a room and hear that story. I mentioned the end of his life. Eddie died a couple of years ago of natural causes, and when I went to his memorial service, close to 300 people, Eddie, in his remaining years out of prison, had found work, obviously. He had found his own apartment through Quaker Housing, was able to find housing. He met a woman through church, became engaged. Her family, children and grandchildren, absolutely adored him. He was a gifted musician. He played for some of our fundraisers. He composed music for church, both his own and for the one where his circle of support was housed. That memorial service was such a celebration of a life that somebody at the UW couldn't recognize as inherently having inherent worth and dignity. So, the end of Eddie's story was really that we helped his sister arrange for the funeral and to take his body back down to Illinois, where he was from originally. But she flew in from Florida, his big sister. How many of you have older siblings? You know, sometimes they kind of have thoughts about how you should have lived your life. I know mine does. She really didn't know over the years, although they had remained in contact, they hadn't been close, and she never knew if she could really believe whether Eddie had changed his life around. And so as she sat in that service and looked at the friends and the connections and the people that loved her brother, it was incredibly healing for her. 60% of our reentry staff at Madison Area Urban Ministry are formerly incarcerated. And it just so happens that John Givens, who coordinates our Circles of Support program that Eddie had been involved in, had served time with Eddie. And so in the fellowship time, John sat and I watched Eddie's sister and John talk, and she was just, as John was regaling her of stories of Eddie's exploits in prison. It was just that final healing that needed to happen for that family. But Eddie's experience with the fry cook thing got us thinking. And it got us thinking about all the doors that slam shut when it comes to employment. And we said, you know what, we need to create our own doors. We're just gonna need to start our own program. And so finally, after 6 years of dreaming, in September of last year, we launched our Just Bakery Vocational Training and Employment Program. So Just Bakery is a 16-week program. People learn life skills, math tutoring, ServSafe certification, which is a nationally recognized food safety certification. They go into the Feed Kitchen, which is the food enterprise, economic enterprise development kitchen on the north side, and they learn commercial baking. We have a line of products that are for sale. Right now we're selling them through our faith communities. So on Sundays, we're at various congregations selling baked goods. The proceeds go back into the program. Our goal is that people come out with a ServSafe certification and a certification for training from the Wisconsin Bakers Association, with whom we're working now. They've created a written test and will come in and observe students who are ready for that final test. We've hired three of our program participants. One is teaching our ServSafe certification piece, and two of them are on our staff now part-time as our production people. So on Fridays, Saturdays, and Sundays, they're working with us, creating the baked goods that people are buying. And then they're also getting customer service experience on Sundays. But it was Eddie's experience that really said, we need to do something different. So my shameless plug for volunteers, Circles of Support, and we also, as a part of the Just Bakery program, want to provide job coaching and mentoring as well for people while they're in there. So Just Bakery is kind of, we're here, but Eddie helped us get there, and stories like Eddie's. I mentioned the children's programs. You know, one of the things that people forget is that, in terms of the kids, how much they struggle. And Keith and Sarah are two kids that we really watched grow up. Keith entered the program, they started the first year, so that we started the Mentoring Connections program. And in 2012, their mom was, Keith was four at the time, and Sarah was seven. So their mom was diagnosed with stage four terminal brain cancer in 2012. Now they happened to be matched with two incredible mentors, a married couple. And when their mom was diagnosed, their mentors were there to help support mom, to help support the kids. The first time mom collapsed at home about midnight, the kids were there, they woke up, they heard the commotion, they didn't know who to call, they called their mentors, who called 911 and then immediately came over to their home and picked the kids up because the kids had nowhere to go. As mom got sicker, the mentors helped her figure out and navigate where the kids could live on a more permanent basis, helped negotiate with relatives. Mom went into a nursing home. The kids went to live in Illinois with relatives. Their mentors went routinely and regularly to Illinois to bring the kids up here to visit their mom. Because what happens sometimes with the caregivers, and this is what happened for the aunt who took the kids in, she didn't have the extra money. And she already brought two additional mouths into her household to feed. We don't care enough as a society about the kids of incarcerated parents to routinely make sure that they're okay. Nobody's asking at the time of sentencing, where are your kids gonna go? Nobody was asking mom, where are your kids gonna go? But she knew she had the mentors there to help her. So anyway, they were bringing the kids up here because the aunt didn't have the gas money to bring the kids up. So the day that their mom died, Jackie, I still get a little emotional. Their mentors had brought them up that day so that Keith and Sarah got to spend the morning with their mom and were there when she died. They're back in Illinois, but they still have regular contact with their mentors, who, as far as they're concerned, will have contact and maintain that relationship with the kids as long as they want. Now, Sarah's in college, but part of the goal of that program is to provide that stable adult presence and additional support network. And that's an extreme case where that really came into play, but it's part of what kids experience. So as important as those programs are, and I'm watching the time, because now it's 1 o'clock, right? As important as those programs are to the people involved in them and to our staff, and that's charity. Theologian William Sloan Coffin, I think, really described, not intentionally, obviously, but I think described the work of Mom when he said, charity, yes, always, but never as a substitute for justice. So those are the programs at Mom that focus on charity. But it's not the justice end of it. The justice end of it is the advocacy work that we do. The justice part of it was putting a request into the county Department of Administration to say, you know, there's something that doesn't make sense to us in terms of the county human services budget, because every year for the last, from 2000 to 2010, Dane County has cut the human services budget. And every year you tell us that you're going to have to cut because there's not enough money, but it never makes sense to us because, you know what, out of all of the millions of dollars in the Dane County human services budget, about 30% of it is actually yours and my county, is actually county money. The rest of it is the money that all of the agencies that the county contracts with draw down through state and federal programs. So it never made sense to us. So we put in a request to the Department of Administration because we couldn't see it. And guess what? Every year for 10 years, the county human services budget had a surplus. But at the end of the year, before they closed the books, they quietly pulled out the equivalent amount of tax, county tax money, GPR dollars, our property tax dollars, to balance it out to zero, and then use that money that they had said they were going to use for human services to plug holes in the budget elsewhere. So when the new county executive was elected, and we didn't make a lot of friends when we pointed that out. But we went to the new county executive with a delegation of 25 clergy. And we said, the faith communities of Dane County spend millions of dollars to support the safety net in our county. And we expect the county to be honest and to do the same and be willing to spend the same kind of energy and resources. And so we garnered a commitment from the new county executive at that time to not only stop that practice, but to meet with us at least twice a year as a delegation of faith communities to talk about what we were seeing, what the ministers and people who staff the church offices were seeing in terms of the basic need. We administer two eviction prevention funds, one through Allied Partners, which I know this congregation is very familiar with, and one through First Unitarian. So each year I write about $20,000 worth of checks, ranging anything from $30 to $200 to help families in our community stay in their houses. The county needs to hear that. So I now, when I write checks, I routinely send a little note to the full county board and say, I just wrote 6 checks today, and here's the situations people found themselves in. And I know they probably are really tired of hearing from me, but they need to hear that. We worked a lot on housing and homelessness, and I'm going to wrap up so we have time to, before Molly just drags it up. But some of the most recently, in 2012, the county board asked us to convene an interim committee to look at and study possible alternative sites to Occupy Madison when Occupy was down on East Washington Street. So we decided that was fine, we would do that, but we were going to do it right, which meant we were going to look at more than just how can we shuffle a bunch of people around from space to space, because what are the real needs? Why are people having to live down there in the first place? So we convened a committee of faith community representatives, clergy, people who had been living at Occupy, shelter providers, agency providers, allies, and one elected official who came, Marcia Rummel. And we put together a report that we presented to the county board in July of 2012 that had a host of recommendations, including, as we looked at the gaps, storage facilities for people who are homeless, greater access to showers, public restrooms downtown that are open 24/7. We looked at the need for greater single room occupancy housing because the vacancy rate for apartments in the city of Madison is below 2%. And because of changes to the tenant rights laws that this legislature has made, it's incredibly difficult for people to find housing. We need more affordable housing. We need more low income housing. And if you look at, this is one of those situations, I went to a church one day, I was talking about this and someone from the city came up to me afterwards and said, call me, I work on this. The city has a lot of development projects underway, and among them are about 2,400 apartment units, part of mixed-use projects going on, and not one of them is affordable housing. Not one of them. 2,400 new apartments that are TIF financed, not one of them. So those are the kinds of advocacy issues we work on, but then we also engage with some innovative projects, including tiny houses. So, Occupy Madison has kind of reinvigorated itself and is working as a nonprofit now to build affordable housing of its own. 98 square foot tiny houses that are on trailers. The advocacy part of it, we worked along with Occupy Madison with Marcia Rummel and some alders to revamp some of the zoning, some of the ordinances in Dane County, or the city of Madison, excuse me, that would allow the tiny homes to be on nonprofit, including church property, so that people could live there. They have composting toilets, they have solar panels to run some electricity for cell phone lighting, and they also have outside vented propane heaters. So the first house is done. There's two others under construction. I say we because I serve on the board for Occupy Madison. But the tiny houses are a very cool project. We are looking right now at purchasing a piece of land on East Johnson Street where we would be able to put 11 houses. So we're working through the city process on that. The other thing, though, that we identified in that study, the report that we gave to the county, was the need for a medical shelter for people who are homeless. If you can imagine, and these are true stories, having had a double mastectomy, you're in the hospital 3 days, you're discharged, you're homeless, and your discharge orders are to follow up with medical treatment and get rest. But when are the shelters open? Who's going to help you changing dressings? Who's going to help you with medication? I sat next to at a hearing, a county health and human needs committee hearing last October with a gentleman who walked in 2 days after having had a stroke, who was homeless. He was discharged with his cane and his bag of his belongings. There was no home health, there was no follow-up care provided. What we have for medical shelter in Dane County is $10,000 worth of vouchers for motels that the Salvation Army has to provide for people. And that may work really well when, you know, you're sick for a couple days with a stomach bug and you need some place to land. It doesn't work real well when you're going through chemotherapy or you're recuperating from a stroke. So we created a medical respite task force, and we've studied the issue, and now we are looking at developing two medical shelter facilities. Our first priority, and part of it is just because we've identified a site, we need to do a lot of fundraising. But our goal is to, within a year, to open a family medical respite program 24/7 so that families with children who have, if the parents or the children have medical needs that as they're being discharged from the hospital, they have some place to be. And someplace, and we were working with the hospitals, all of whom have home health providers, and all of these individuals who are homeless would be eligible for home health if only they had a home. Mm-hmm. If only they had an address. And so we're going to give them an address. And we know we will be overwhelmed an under capacity as soon as we open, but we have to move forward with it. So those are some of the things that we're working on. We always welcome people to join the respite task force. Molly is doing a little work behind the scenes already for us. But that's where we are today. We are on the move. We've taken on just a couple of small projects for this year. So open a bakery and open a shelter. but we think it's doable. I mean, that's part about being a faith-based organization. We believe, I had an argument one time, I was responding to something on Facebook that someone wrote about the Cubs, because I'm a Cubs fan. That's how I learned about faith.
It's always next year.
It's always next year. And it was Mayor Cheslevich at the time who was chastising me for how could I have faith. And I said, you know, faith is really believing that something can happen, or believing in someone despite the evidence to the contrary, right? I mean, I had somebody once tell me that, oh, Unitarians, because I used to belong to a Unitarian church down in Illinois. They once told me, oh yeah, Unitarianism, that doesn't require a leap of faith. And, you know, 33 years in human services experience came back to me and I said, you know, we believe in the inherent worth and dignity of every person requires sometimes, especially when I'm working with elected officials, an incredible leap of faith. So that's Mom on the Move, and I will stop talking and be happy to answer questions. In November, we expanded our Reading Connections program to Waupun Prison, which is a maximum institution for dads, for men, many of whom are dads. We don't have the funding right now. One of the things with our children's programs, they are entirely funded through private, individual, congregational donations and some small foundations. So EVU Foundation, Alliant Energy, Downtown Rotary. So they're not huge programs, but we receive no United Way funding or government funding for our children's programs. Again, it's something we are committed to doing, but expansion then is kind of small. But we were very happy to be able to go to Waupun now. And so for the men there, they're at least able to do the Reading Connections portion of the story. Well, the way the ordinance is now, it would have to be, there's part of the challenge with tiny houses is nowhere else in Wisconsin is this being done, and so nobody knows how to classify them. The state doesn't know how to classify them, and the county and the city don't really know how to classify them, but the city is working with us to try to classify them. So right now, though, the ordinance says it has to be the property for the tiny houses. The tiny houses would have to be on the property of a nonprofit, which can include churches. And there have to be some other services available on that site. So it might be just that the church provides financial assistance for gas cards, or it might be a meal site or food pantry. So that's kind of where we are right now. Now, the spot on East Johnson is the old Sanchez Motors location. And Occupy Madison is raising the funds, and we have enough for the down payment. We've been approved for the loan, and we have enough for the first 3 years of mortgage payment. So the goal is to purchase that property. It's got to move through the zoning process. We're getting really good support from the Alder, Larry Palm, in that district. There are some neighbors with concerns. There are some neighbors who are very supportive of the project. But it is one of those weird things that, because they're on trailers, they're not really considered homes. Mm-hmm. They're really considered kind of campers. Mm-hmm. And so right now, part of why it's a challenge is if we park them on the street, they're gonna have to be moved every couple days, just like a car would or a camper would, and that is gonna take a toll on the house itself, not to mention. So we really want a place where we can recreate the sense of community that people had to occupy. And the rules, and it, for people who may not be familiar with the tiny houses and Occupy, so you have to be a member of Occupy, you have to put in sweat equity hours to be able to be eligible for a tiny home. And that can be either working on a home, or it could be working in the office or the shop, doing things depending on your own ability. I know they probably wouldn't want me around power tools, so I do some fundraising. So that's kind of where it's at. We're trying to figure out the zoning stuff, because the state is saying, well, you know, it's not really a campground, but maybe it's a campground, but not really, because you want them to be there permanently, but yet they're movable. So there's still some things to be worked out, but so in terms of the property right now, the goal is this piece of land where Sanchez Motors is, but eventually we would like to have a much bigger piece of land where we could replicate some of the other tiny house villages that are in other parts of the country, including Dignity Village out on the Pacific Northwest. So, well, we haven't. I mean, right now it's the city and the county both have put money in their budgets for single room occupancy development, and so that's kind of who's looking for the properties. And I know people have gone back and forth on the Royster Clark property about whether that would be a good site. Right now we're still struggling with getting the county to site a full-time day shelter. So they have four people who are homeless can be from, you know, 7:30 a.m. till 5 p.m. when there's the regular overnight shelters are closed. So we haven't been able, right now it looks like what'll happen with that, with the day shelter piece of it, is it looks like Porchlight is looking at giving up their location for Hospitality House that could become, with some renovations, a day center. The question is whether it's big enough. Right now the county is funding kind of interim day center services, so Bethel Lutheran Church is doing some things. Another nonprofit called Shine 608 is providing services in the library. And can I just say, the Madison Public Library has been exceptional in making space and making the library as welcoming as possible for people who are homeless to spend time, and making space available for Shine to be there and provide some services. So.
I just want to say, since I have the pulpit, that in my work, we refer people to Madison Urban Ministry because of child support all the time. People who have coming out of corrections who are saying, I can't get a job. And I say, you know, then you know about Madison Urban Ministry. The court commissioners know about it. They refer people all the time. So there's no end to the good work they do. And for closing words, this is from Jules Pfeiffer. I used to think I was poor. Then they told me I wasn't poor, I was needy. They told me it was self-defeating to think of myself as needy. I was deprived. Then they told me underprivileged was overused. I was disadvantaged. I still don't have a dime, but I have a great vocabulary. Please greet your neighbor. Neighbors.